Hi everybody, and welcome on behalf of LSE Cities and LSE Spectrum to this event, Queering the African City, Johannesburg and Nairobi. I won't spend a long time introducing our speakers because I'm sure you want to get on and hear what they have to say. Mark Gefisser is a very decorated journalist and author. He's won numerous prizes. And just for the sake of today, it's notable that his first book, which was an edited book, Defiant Desire, Gay and Lesbian Lives in South Africa, that was published in 1994. He later followed with a series of portraits and biographies of, you know, important people, powerful people, and specifically one book, Thabo Mbeki, The Dream Deferred, which I was lucky enough to read in a slightly shorter version than the full version, but it was extremely interesting. And finally, has published this fourth book, Lost and Found in Johannesburg, which we'll be talking about a bit today, and is now here to publicize a new anthology of writing to which he's contributed, Safe House, Explorations in Creative Nonfiction. So we're looking forward to hearing from him. Andrew van der Vlies is going to be introducing and interrogating Mark, or rather conversing. Conversing with him.
I didn't realize that's what it was about.
No. He's a reader in global Anglophone literature and theory in the Department of English at Queen Mary University. And I always like to be present at an event with him because it reminds me we're all part of the same university in the end, even if we have these separate identities. He's written numerous books, including a monograph, South African Textual Cultures, another book on J.M. Coetzee's Disgrace. And he's the editor of Print Text and Book Cultures in South Africa and the lead editor of Safundi, the Journal of South African and American Studies. So welcome to all of you, and over to the two speakers.
Thank you. So I have an introduction too, but I guess it'll segue into a description of Mark's book, Lost and Found in Johannesburg, and we'll talk about that a little bit. Mark will read from that, and then we'll move to a discussion of the piece that was published in Safe House, and talk a bit more about the project that Mark's working on at the moment. So I'll try not to read too much that repeats what Deborah said. I'll just say I'm very pleased to be here, and it's nice to see you all here. So Mark is a native of Johannesburg and has written very movingly and with extraordinarily luminous insight about that city in his 2014 memoir, Lost and Found in Johannesburg. Very handsome book. Exhibit A. Was published in this country as Dispatcher, but Mark tells me it's been released now under the title that it has in its American and South African editions. And as Deborah said, he's also one of South Africa's foremost writers. And here I could use a number of other words: analyst, commentator, critic, public intellectual, activist, archivist, and biographer, amongst others. They're all very useful terms, but none quite captures the range of Mark's output or the breadth of his interests and abilities. So I think polymath might be a term we could use for Mark. He also writes very beautiful prose, which is important to me. I'm in an English department. Mark's the author, as Deborah said, of Legacy of Liberation, Thabo Mbeki and the Futures of the South African Dream. And as she's also said, edited with Edwin Cameron, that very important book, Defiant Desire. It's a really important bringing together of stories of gay and lesbian lives under apartheid, which has been generative for all sorts of other work in the field in the 20 years, 21 years, 22 years since it was published. It's again, summary descriptions are inadequate, but it's an engagement with the project that he's working on at the moment, which is, I think, provisionally titled Global Sexuality Frontier.
Yeah.
Is that right? Yeah. So this project is what we'll end up talking about, I think, and what I'm guessing most of you will want to hear about. It's an engagement, as I understand it, with the rise of sexuality rights discourse internationally and the tricky, always fraught negotiations amongst global or cosmopolitan understandings of sexuality, especially same-sex sexuality, if we can use that shorthand for now, as it meets local conditions, laws, practices, discourses, and so on. All right, so that sort of maps out the terrain, to use a metaphor that is probably appropriate in this particular venue. The starting point for Lost and Found in Johannesburg, this book that we'll start talking about, as Mark explains in an essay published in the Mail and Guardian in 2011, was a childhood game that he used to play, which he's retroactively called Dispatcher, which used his parents' copy of a kind of map book of Johannesburg called Holmdon's Register of Johannesburg, which he used to spur imaginative mental journeys across the landscape of that strange and fascinating place. And I quote from that essay, and I think that essay may have made it into the book in a slightly different form. "We lived in Hurlingham on page 79, and it was from here that I would dispatch imaginary couriers across the world of the Holmdons. I would open the Johannesburg telephone directory at random and settle on a name and an address, look for the address in the Holmdon's index, locate it on the map pages, and then give my man intricate directions on how to get there. Other map-making activities derived from the dispatcher, such as plotting new suburbs, multiracial suburbs, in the white spaces of the Holmdons." And there's a great chapter, Treasure Valley, I think it's called, which is about that. Of course, there are ironies, Mark discovers, on reflection when he looks back at this childhood game. The maps in Holmdon's were all hand-drawn. They were not consistent either in scale or in orientation, and they didn't show, crucially, how the parts of the city related to each other. They also, he discovers when he goes back, left out Soweto, right? So they were partial guides to a fantasy city, if you like, a city that existed in the fantasy of its white residents in all sorts of ways. So there's a dark side, a messiness, which he discovers, and the volume is kind of an engagement. It's an act of recuperative memory work, in a sense, to try and think through what fell between the gaps of those maps in the cracks in the spine, so to speak. So just two more very brief extracts from Mark's description. "My nostalgia for the map book of my childhood is, of course, one for the certitudes of its bounded cartography, the comforts of my generally easy and happy childhood. But it also triggers a thrill at the prospect of crossing these boundaries. I find myself going back to the Holmdons because it forces me to remember something I must never allow myself to forget. Johannesburg, my hometown, the city I think I know, is not the city I think I know. I've decided to look at my nostalgia for the Holmdons in an attempt to understand it more critically, and in doing so, I have had the eerie but illuminating experience of viewing my childhood from above, as if it were a map itself, along which I have been able to plot my route to the present, alongside that of my hometown's growth." It's a really lovely idea of Johannesburg growing as Mark has, you know, grew himself. And one of the things that emerges in this book, of course, is a story of Mark's own coming to consciousness of himself as a South African with a conscience, if you like, but also as a South African male, white, Jewish descent, middle class, privileged, and gay, right? So there's a story of how all of those different identity categories allow him to navigate the city in certain ways. And as I've said, this helps him to see a great deal that's fallen between the cracks of all of those categories. So, I read this book when it came out about 2 years ago, and even before I returned to it, I'd retained very clear memories of a number of stories that Mark tells very engagingly, have lodged in my mind, and the images are, for example, a photograph of a multiracial swimming party in Bram Fischer's swimming pool, which is a very extraordinary story, emerges from that. The weather-beaten, time-worn hands of an elderly black man who lives in Soweto, and we discover the various kinds of lives he's been able to lead, but also has had to repress. And then also the remarkable section in the book, which is the middle section, which describes a quite terrifying experience that Mark and two friends had of being held hostage during a house invasion. So that gives you a sense of the kind of work that the book does. I mean, I can't really do it justice. So much happens and so much is unpacked. But I think I'd like to invite Mark to begin our discussion, or whatever this is, reading discussion, by offering us a snippet from the book, and I'll let him tell you what he's chosen to read.
Thank you so much, Andrew. That was a very wonderful, warm and generous introduction. So I'm conscious of the fact that there's sort of two hosts to this event. One is LSE Cities, right? There's city people here, and then the other's the LSE LGBT organization, LGBTI organization, which is called?
Spectrum.
So there are people interested in cities, and there's people interested in sexuality and gender identity. Yeah. I'm assuming everyone here is interested in one or other of those things, and hopefully the confluence, because it's really the confluence that I want to talk about, or that I hope we talk about. Because that's sort of my abiding interest is in, I mean, Andrew read a little section about triggering a thrill, and I'm really interested in the way that cities trigger thrills, and what happens to thrills in an urban space, and what happens to the possibility to imagine yourself outside of what might be socially destined for you when you enter an urban space. And in a way, those are the ideas that sort of animate all my work, and certainly the work we're going to be looking at today. And it's something I'm really happy to talk about, so hopefully there'll be enough time for us to talk too about it. I'm going to read, the extract I'm going to read from here is from a section in the book which kind of looks a little bit at queer history in Johannesburg. And tries to grapple with the way in Johannesburg specifically, but as in any multicultural, multi-class city, sexual identities and racial identities and class identities and gender identities might kind of coexist, bash into each other, find themselves separated from each other in a city like Johannesburg, certainly, which is an apartheid city, certainly separate from each other. So. I'm going to read you a few paragraphs from this, and it begins with the description of a newspaper headline: 350 in mass sex orgy. This was the headline of the Rand Daily Mail that landed at our front door on the 22nd of January 1966, when I was 1 year old. A queer party had been raided in Witchwood Road, in the Johannesburg suburb of Forest Town. 9 men had been arrested for masquerading as women, and 1 for indecent assault on a minor. Masquerading was on the books to prevent criminals from concealing their identities by dressing up as women, but it was occasionally used to intimidate drag queens and gay cross-dressers when nothing else was at hand to charge them with. Remember, this is 1966. It's before people in Johannesburg, at least, had a transgender identity, even though many of those people who were intimidated may well, if they live today, call themselves trans. One of those arrested on these charges was the hairdresser, Michel Bruno, who was wearing his showstopper ostrich feather coat. There had been a few of these parties in the past, Michel told me, but this was the biggest one yet. It was heavily advertised. No wonder the police found out about it. There was really nothing illegal going on. They were just looking for a way to intimidate us. Bruno remembers being at the party in a grand old Forest Town house and feeling a tap on my shoulder. I turned round and there was this man dressed in a suit who said, "Excuse me, lady, you're under arrest for masquerading." He said, "Lady." I suddenly got cold and this very handsome policeman said, "Don't worry, dearie," and helped me into my coat. In the car, one of these policemen put his hand up my skirt. I'm sure it was just to see. We were taken to the Greys and then to Marshall Square. They called me into a room. They tell me to strip until I'm standing just in a black bra with red suspender belt holding up the stockings and the cotton wool sticking out of the bra and men's underpants. Then she goes on to explain to me that the reason why she was wearing men's underpants is because she knew that if she was caught wearing women's underpants, the charge would be more. So she was wise to that. 3 years before the riots following the police raid of a gay bar in Greenwich Village, South Africa underwent its own Stonewall moment. This raid, the Forest Town raid, provoked a massive public outcry, and a parliamentary commission of inquiry was launched. According to the official police report, officers had found a party in progress the likes of which had never been seen in this country. The Justice Minister proclaimed, "We should not allow ourselves to be deceived into thinking we may casually dispose of this viper in our midst by regarding it as innocent fun. It is a proven fact that sooner or later, homosexual instincts make their effects on a community if they are permitted to run riot." Queers were as threatening to the white civilization as communists or miscegenating homosexuals, and the state proposed legislation that would make it illegal to be homosexual. A spirited defense by a law reform movement developed within the gay community. Its meticulous submissions managed to temper the legislation. Nonetheless, three amendments were finally made in 1969 to the Immorality Act. The first was to raise the age of consent for male homosexual acts from 16 to 19. The second was to outlaw dildos, which police reported were the primary tools of trade of lesbianism. And the third was the infamous Men at a Party Clause, which criminalized, quote, "any male person who commits with another male person at a party any act which is calculated to stimulate sexual passion or give sexual gratification." Most absurd was the definition of a party: any occasion with more than two persons present. And that law was on the books until the new constitution came in 1994, and South Africa did away with all its anti-gay legislation and entrenched non-discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation into its constitution. So I carry on. After describing that party in the Forest Town House, by any definition, there was a party going on in roughly the same era as the Witchwood Road raid, in the boys' room inhabited by a domestic worker named Peter, coincidentally also in Forest Town. I heard about the scene from Phil, an older black gay man, who was explaining to me how he shuttled between his straight life in Soweto — he was married with children — and his gay life in the city. Phil was a married grandfather. He owned a home in a middle-class part of Soweto and drove a car, and had been retired for a few years from his clerical job at a commercial company in the city. Wiry and light-skinned, with a neatly trimmed peppercorn beard and expressive crescent-shaped eyes, he had a stammer that might have been exacerbated by age, but he was nonetheless full of gentle mischief and somewhat blunt lasciviousness. He was known as Mr. Soweto, he told me, because of his popularity with the young men, a trail of whom were always in his wake. We got to the stories about Peter's place in Forest Town in a rather roundabout way. I had asked him where, in the days of high apartheid, he had been able to hang out in the city, beyond, of course, the toilets at Park Station, where he did most of his cottaging. He told me about the non-European dining room at Park Station, established by the authorities to show the world that blacks really were separate but equal. It might have been an apartheid PR exercise, but it was also, Phil said, the only place in town where black people were afforded the dignity of being able to sit down and have a drink and eat a meal. According to Phil, most of the waiters at the restaurant were gay, and very quickly a subculture developed around them. Telling me the story, Phil slid into another about female prostitutes who also frequented this restaurant. They'd be picked up by white Johns outside the station, and when they went back to the Johns' homes in the suburbs, they would make an arrangement with the servant in the back room. If the house was raided, the working girl would rush into the boys' room and climb into bed with him, pretending she was his girlfriend. She might be charged with contravening pass regulations, because you needed to have a pass if you were black to come into the white city, but at least she and her client would evade the far more severe Immorality Act, which forbade sex across the colour bar. The reason why Phil was telling me the story became clear as he continued. It was a story about curfew and what one did if one missed the last train, because if you were black in the white city during the apartheid era, you had to be out by nightfall, unless you had very specific permission to stay in the city because you worked as a domestic worker. It was a story about curfew and what one did if one missed the last train. Instead of running to the station where the police would be waiting to pile all the laggards into their vans and haul them off to the fort, you would make your way down the hill to Forest Town and end up, like the prostitutes, in a boys' room. in this instance, in Peter's place. From the way Phil tells it, you might indeed plan to miss the last train back to Soweto. "Oh, brother," he said, slapping his thigh. Those were the days. His room would be full, so full of young men who are afraid to be roaming the streets at night. As was often the custom, Peter raised his bed on sandbags and bricks to protect him from dog demons. And, quote, "he would make a bedding all around him for everyone coming in. I remember one time it was so full you couldn't open the door. I slept against the door, but in the morning when I woke up I was next to the bed, maybe even under the bed, because those were the days. If you've got someone gay next to you, you enjoy yourself for all the dry months you've never had a gay person with you." As an adult, I've lived alongside the suburb of Forest Town for many years. And when I'm in Johannesburg, I drive through the suburb once or twice a day. Each time I do, I get goosebumps thinking of the atomized geography of my hometown, these two underground gatherings that happened contemporaneously in the same leafy old suburb around the time of my first birthday, one in the main house and one in the boys' room, just across the yard and yet off limits to each other.
Great, thanks. I mean, I guess what's most fascinating about that passage, apart from the extraordinary absurdity of the regulation that dictated where everyone could be, whatever they were told they were supposed to be, is how people find how these different characters from different groups found ways to be at an angle to what society expected them to be, or to what legislation required them to be,
and how to meet their needs as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And finding space. I mean, what I find so interesting about the boys' room story for Phil and his friends is this finding space within the confines of the apartheid system to be able to be with other queer people, with other gay men, and in a way. And when I say that you might wish actually to miss the last train.
Yeah.
You know, if Phil gets the last train, he goes back to his wife and kids.
Yeah.
If he misses the last train, he's in this place of danger. He can be arrested.
Yeah.
He can be thrown into jail. But he can be with a whole lot of other people who've also missed the last train, who are also sexual outlaws and urban outlaws. And I think it's fascinating the way subcultures develop around that kind of identity.
Yeah. I guess I'd be interested to hear more about how the people you spoke to, both for Defiant Desire and the stories that you bring together in this book, felt that their dissident sexuality, for another want of another term, was visible. How legible it was to different categories of people. For example, you know, Michelle talks about the party in Forest Town being widely advertised.
Mm.
Like they knew the police were going to show up because everyone knew about it. And I don't know how visible Phil's different lives were to friends in those different communities. You know, the other people who black men who worked and had boys' rooms
mm-hmm.
around in Forest Town, or the friends of his wife in Soweto. So could you say something about that kind of visibility to or different levels mm-hmm. of visibility and invisibility?
Well, I suppose in all queer subcultures, over time and over space, and the work I'm doing right now is looking at how. So this is the work I'm doing is sort of it begins in Johannesburg, which is where I'm from, but I'm now looking at many places all over the world and trying to understand what's happened globally in a conversation around sexuality rights and gender identity rights, and how it's happened so quickly in the last kind of generation, in a way. And what the effects of these conversations are is sort of global Western liberal ideas, if you like, you know, which are political ideas about identity rights, come into contact with the local and often the traditional as well. And what's striking in all the places I've been working is the way code switching is so much part of the subcultural identity across space and across time. So you find, and this is possible in a city. Where, I mean, the thing about cities is that you are somewhat anonymous in a city, right? particularly if you come from somewhere else. And there's a reason why, I mean, there's a really important essay by John D'Amelio on sexuality and capitalism, which is worth looking at for those of you who don't know it. And it's all about how what we understand today as gay identity comes from a moment, the moment of the Industrial Revolution. And it comes from the time when people were uncoupled from family and fealty and moved to the city, left the feudal system collapsed, and rather than just being productive, reproductive, you had to become a productive member of society, and you had to go to the city to be a productive member of society, and you could kind of invent yourself in a certain way. But there would be other people from who knew where you came from who would also be in the city. They might send news back to the countryside about what was going on there. So you develop these ways of working on a whole lot of different planes. And in a way, I think that's where the notion of queer comes from as a concept, is this ability to switch, to look from the outside, to be on the inside, to be in the boys' room as a friend, but you're kind of what's happening in a situation like South Africa, in apartheid South Africa, is you're using some of the institutions which are specifically set up to divide in such a way, and you're kind of re-inhabiting them with your needs. So I talk, for example, a little bit later in the book about how Phil and his friend Edgar rent a room in an all-male migrant labor hostel. I mean, now, these all-male migrant labor hostels are the very, very kind of worst expression of apartheid capitalism. They are terrible. They're carceral institutions in a way. They're places of slave labor, but they're all-male institutions. And also, as Phil and Edgar explain, everybody's drunk there during leisure time, so no one really gives a fuck. Mm-hmm. So they could rent this place and have their relationship without people looking at them. They were kind of re-inhabiting, almost like hermit crabs, these places that had been assigned for them, and reappropriating them in certain ways. But from the outside, they were just black male laborers in the city. From the inside, they had these expressive and effective and sexual lives that were not known about. It that was happening in the boys' room too. I don't know if that's
yeah,
a sort of long, circuitous way of answering your question.
It brings us back to Phil and Edgar, and the chapter in your book called The Ballad of Phil and Edgar, where we revisit Phil and Edgar, and we've just met Phil in the section that Mark read, is beautifully juxtaposed, I think, to your own experience of same-sex marriage, right? Mm. And you talk about your own intimacy and your own sense of the bond in a very moving way. We're already 7:10,
but yeah,
I do
but
like
we started late.
Yeah, we did. So yeah. I guess shall we take the mood of the room? Would we like to hear more about Phil and Edgar, or shall we? I mean, should we ask Mark to read a bit from that section and then maybe start to move towards? I think that gets us closer to the more recent work. Perhaps.
Sure.
Yeah, I would like to hear.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, the context was that I'll quickly tell the story about how I got married, which is that I've been with my partner for like 25 years, and you know, marriage just seems very ridiculous, actually. But he got a job, and I wanted the benefits, and you can get married in South Africa, as here and as in so many places all over the world, increasingly. And so we went off to get married, but we wanted to do it sort of on the down low because we were a little bit embarrassed about getting married. Not because of internalized self-hate, but just because of, you know, the institution of marriage. And I went off to make a booking at this the Home Affairs office to have it done, which is really a grimy, terrible place. And I was late, and the woman didn't want to serve me, and she was really... And she looked up at me. She was a young black woman, and she looked up at me, and she said, "Same sex marriage or normal?" And I said, "Same sex." And she was like, "Ah, you people, you make so much trouble for us. We have to do 5 times as much paperwork for you as we have to do for normal." And then so she thought it out, and she underlined, and she said, now, you know, we have a chapel here, you can bring up to 25 people. And I said, no, we're not going to do that, we're really not making a fuss, it's like, we're just doing this because, you know, I want to spend a bit. And she said, what's wrong with you? Why don't you want to make a fuss? And then she said, and don't forget to bring the rings. And I said, no, we're not doing rings. And she said, you don't want to make a fuss, right? She said, I want to tell you something, sit down. She said, you think you're a second-class citizen because you're gay. You're not. You have the same rights as everybody else. Come back here with your 25 guests and your rings and make an event of it. And it was this extraordinary moment. Here I am, I'm a middle-class white, entitled, middle-aged man being lectured at by a young black woman about, like, how I need to own my rights. It was very beautiful, and then I described the wedding in the book, which was hilarious. It was absolutely hilarious. We didn't bring 25 people, but we did get rings. And I imagine at this wedding, because we didn't bring 25 people, I filled the pews where the 25 people might have been with the people that I thought should be there. And among those people were Phil, who you've already met, and his friend Edgar. And when I find the right place, their own wedding bands were the first thing I noticed when I met Phil and his friend Edgar for the first time in 1998 at a Soweto tavern named Scotch's Place. Both rings were assertive and masculine, planed rather than curved, and spoke of the substance and solidity of their wearers. Edgar, like Phil, was a married grandfather. He owned a home, well, I've already told you about the middle class, Soweto, etc. These were the days when a wedding ring still meant you were straight or in the closet. And so Edgar and Phil's fingers flashed a particular code as the two men sat in the semi-obscurity of Scotch's interior, having chosen a table that put them directly in the flight path between the door to the yard and the bar. As patrons streamed in and out, Phil or Edgar would mutter something sotto voce, and a young man or two would linger for a moment, engage in conversation, and maybe sit down. By the time I left 3 hours later, chairs had been pulled up all around them and tables pulled together. All these kids had impossibly waspy waists, with button-down shirts neatly tucked into smart pressed jeans, or tank tops riding well above the navel. Look at them, Phil said with desire and disapproval. We are not as free as they are today. Today they are very free, very showy, and you can see them a miles away. I wouldn't go around with a boy in a skinny top and a belly button outside. No. Edgar and Phil themselves dressed with conservative style, sharp shoes, crisply ironed slacks, Pringle shirts, fine watches. If Phil was diminutive and light-skinned, Edgar was tall, dark, and well-built. A typical Zulu man, Phil riposted playfully, pinching him in the side. Edgar had the easy, straightforward confidence of a matinee idol or the lay preacher that he was. His shirt collar was open to a gold chain, and he was given to exuberant laughter and emphatic stress. The men bantered gently with each other, their intimacy suggesting that they might be old and comfortable lovers, which is how many saw them, although neither used this term to describe themselves. Their friend Roger, a white man who introduced me to them and them to each other, told me that he believed that in another life, a free life, Phil and Edgar would have been a couple. Over the course of our relationship, both suggested to me, in one way or another, that this might have been so. Both men moved to Johannesburg with their families. This is my point about people coming to cities and what happens. Both men moved to Johannesburg with their families during the wartime boom years when they were little boys. Edgar from Zululand and Phil from the farmlands of the Orange Free State. Both families settled in Pimville, the black township that was the germ of Soweto, although Edgar and Phil would meet only as adults. Their fathers found jobs and their mothers took in washing. And so Edgar and Phil, like so many sons of Soweto, would be sent into town to fetch and drop the laundry at white people's homes. As happens with boys all over the world when they discover trains and cities, their lives changed. Having delivered the goods for his mother, Edgar told me, he would go fishing, as he liked to put it, in Joubert Park or Park Station on his way back from the township. I was 16, a Zulu boy, hefty, plumpy. I wore shorts, very tight shorts. I was a fit young boy. Men of all races would be attracted to me. Delivering washing for his mother provided Phil, too, with access to the city. He was seduced by one of her clients and realized the possibilities of the world beyond Soweto. He dropped out of school, much to the fury of his ambitious parents. I was too streetwise, Phil explained to me. I liked the money. It was my chance of meeting men. One of Phil's favorite haunts was Union Grounds in Joubert Park, where white soldiers were barracked after the war. He is on one side of the fence, and you are on the other. He pulls down his pants. He puts his what's-his-name through the fence. You put your hand through the fence and get hold of him, and you do your thing. There and then, he gives you sixpence. When I asked if he was worried about being seen, he deadpanned back. The lights in those days were not as bright as the lights today. And I love that because it says something, and I think something very important in what I'm researching now, and it's, a lot has been written about it, there's been a shift globally from behavior to identity. As this thing is given a name, as it becomes a kind of rights identity, and people begin claiming their rights in a certain way, the lights get brighter. And whereas before, you know, two men in a hammam could be kind of washing each other's backs and the hands might drift somewhere, now people are on the lookout for this thing, which is, you know, against the law, and which has been named, and such behavior might be more suspect. And it's a very interesting moment we find ourselves in, particularly in the, I've noticed it particularly in the parts of Africa where I've been doing the research on my book, there were all these spaces which were kind of subterranean but accommodated, have light shone on them now, by the rights discourse, by young people in particular, claiming the right to be themselves and owning a certain kind of visibility. And for older people who are used to working in the shadows in that way, it's very threatening. So it's an interesting transition. It happens in different places and in different ways in different places.
Yeah, and I think that passage illustrates all of those coming together of all of those different, or shows us figures negotiating all of those different claims on their identity and activating different kinds of code switching. I think that leads really nicely into the new project, which you've begun to describe for us. So perhaps we can move to talk a bit more about that. And as you say, about the kind of light that rights discourse has shone on practices which are now required to be named in particular ways, and that, of course, causes all sorts of problems. So some of the other connections between that passage that you just read and the very moving extract, I'm calling it an extract, very moving account, which I imagine will find a place in the new book, of a young Ugandan refugee who ends up in Nairobi. And it's in Nairobi that, well, you meet him in Kampala, I think, but then you meet him again in Nairobi. And there are all sorts of connections, the discourse of acting masculine versus walking girly, which is the title of that story, the way in which ethnic identity is required to be performed in particular ways, but also possibly allows space for other kinds of behavior, right? And I'm thinking of the troops' performance at the end of that story. And also religion. So one of the contributors, Philo Edgar, is a lay preacher.
Yes.
And of course, the language of religion, both as accommodating individuals' rights to be themselves, but also as anathematizing satanic gay behavior, is of course all referenced in that story, in that account. So perhaps we could have a little bit of that.
Sure. Okay. So I'll tell you, it's published in an anthology called Safe House Explorations in African Nonfiction, which is on sale outside as well as my memoir. And I think this is, I mean, buy my memoir if you want to, but I think this is an important book for those, particularly who are interested in kind of queer African stories, because there are four or five in this book. It's a new collection, Just Art, published by a Nigerian publisher, a wonderful Nigerian publisher called Cassava Republic. And it's the point was to commission African writers to tell African stories in African ways, and to look at, to, particularly when it comes to queer stuff, to try and change the narrative, which is that LGBTI is a Western obsession, and that it's kind of Westerners who have taken this obsession, and they're shining the light. I mean, I don't know how many of you, has anyone here read Joseph Massad? So Joseph Massad writes about how it's kind of, he's a Middle Eastern studies person, but he writes very much about how it's a kind of Western gay obsession to find the gay in the global south, basically so that the Western gay can identify the black gay and fuck him. You know, that I mean, I'm putting it crudely, but that's his notion. So from that perspective, or from the homophobic perspective, which is, you know, that LGBTI rights discourse, that homosexuality, that a kind of biomedical approach to transgenderism, that these are all Western things and we need to defend our African culture, our cultural sovereignty, our values, our ethics, from this kind of Western liberal deluge. So from both sides you get this argument. And that's the kind of, that latter is the current geopolitics around particularly sexual orientation that I'm looking at in my new project. So what this book is trying to do is to say, no, let's listen to Africans talk about this themselves. And so there's some great pieces in here on that. What I did for this book is that I wrote an essay called Walking Girly in Nairobi. And I'll just read the introduction to it, and then we can talk a little bit about the person I'm writing about and his story, because it expresses so many of the ideas that you've already kind of underscored, Andrew. After my meeting with Peter, I dropped him on the Ngong Road to get a matatu, or minibus, back to where he lived, outside of the city, in a communal house with 20 other refugees. I watched him tuck his long braids back into his red beanie and marshal his slight frame, rendered even skinnier by his tight green jeans, into the step of the street. He arranged his eloquent features into a blank rictus of masculinity and disappeared into the rush hour throng. If asked a question by someone else in the matatu, he would try to mutter something in Kiswahili, he told me, even though this was a language he barely spoke. If he answered in English, he would be identified as a foreigner. If there were a policeman, he might be asked to show his papers. And that is where the trouble will begin, he said. There's no war in Uganda, so when somebody sees that I'm an asylum seeker here, they know there can be only one reason. A few hours earlier, I had watched Peter pull the beanie off and shake out his braids, parted in a line along the top of his crown, so that they fell down the sides of his head to make a heart of his fine-boned face. I had not seen him in a year, and I noted immediately how he was both more feminine and more assertive than the shy and composed boy I had met in Kampala. There was something in his manner, even in the way he threw his tote bag down in rage and frustration, that told me he had stepped into himself since I had seen him last. Just 19, he had been in Nairobi for 6 months, seeking asylum on the basis of his sexual orientation. He'd come to me straight from the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, where he'd been to get new documentation. This was because his papers had been torn up by Kenyan policemen when he had refused to pay a bribe. At first, he told me, the guards at UNHCR had mocked him and denied him entry. You Ugandans are bringing sin to Kenya. Finally, he'd been granted access. But when his new papers had been issued, he'd been told that he would have to repeat the refugee eligibility interview he'd done a few weeks previously. This had thrown him into a panic. They don't believe me, that I'm a real LGBTI, I know it. They must think I'm one of the fraudsters. And the story there is basically what happened was, is the UNHCR made it, because there was this flood of refugees from Uganda when the Anti-Homosexuality Act was passed there, the UNHCR made it much easier than normal for these refugees to get their papers and be resettled, because it was clear that they were very vulnerable in Kenya, which is, you know, at least as homophobic as Uganda is in terms of social mores, religion, etc. And because of this, there was a kind of an even greater flood of people who came because it was made easier. So there were a whole lot of cases of fraud that were found. So then they put the gates down, the UNHCR, and put the LGBTI refugees into the same boat as everybody else. So suddenly you've got this population of young queer refugees in Uganda who really don't, who are much more vulnerable, and who don't, and this is the situation right now, and who don't have communities into which they can slot like Somali refugees do or Congolese refugees do. They're kind of unmoored, and they're there. So I then followed Peter back to the place he was staying. Peter's mentor at the communal house was a man in his early 40s, a primary school teacher named Joseph, who'd been fired from his job when his sexuality was revealed. "Peter is my daughter," Joseph told me. "Since he has come to Nairobi, he is so much more comfortable with himself. He is realizing that he is not gay, but actually transgender. That is why he gets slapped so often in the streets for walking girly." Peter agreed with this assessment, and had even chosen a female name for himself. But this would have to wait until he was resettled in the West, he told me. For now, he needed to hold his femininity in check if he was going to survive. "Why then," I asked, "did he get the braids?" "I did it because, ha, I just felt I needed to be myself. In Uganda, there were rules, but here I'm independent. No one can tell me, don't do this, don't dress like that, Peter, don't braid your hair." Peter needed the braids, and he needed the beanie, the former as part of his process of self-actualization, and the latter to keep that very process in check, given where he found himself. It would be a difficult balancing act for anyone to maintain, let alone an impetuous 19-year-old just discovering his agency in the world. He had left Uganda on a journey towards being himself after a violent and suppressive adolescence, where his very survival was at risk because of who he was. His crossing the border to Kenya was the first step towards this imagined freedom, to the life that he believed awaited him in his preferred destination, the United States. And he was living with a group of other people with exactly the same expectations. How, in such a context, do you temper such expectation? How do you gather up your hope, particularly after such objection, and pile it back into the beanie? So one of the things Peter and the others really struggle with in Nairobi is they're told by the UNHCR to be on the down low. They're told that they have to be discreet. They're told that they have to pretend, even if someone stops them and says, "What are you doing here?" They have to pretend they're political refugees. But their process of going into exile has been one of trying to free themselves and be themselves. So they're caught in this impossible situation.
And of course what they have to try and do is find a structure that will accommodate this identity that they feel they've been free to embrace by leaving, both spatially and also emotionally.
But also politically, because it's very interesting. I don't know if you heard, I said Peter refers to himself as an LGBTI.
Yes.
Right? So there's a certain, he's taken on that identity because that identity has some global currency.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And it's an identity that's going to help him get his refugee papers. Right. Now, I don't know. I mean, he's a kid. I use the word he because he asked me to use the word he. But now there's some talk about trans identity and so much of this is, you know, I mean, it's as I think, well, I don't know. I can only speak for myself. I mean, I'm a bit of a constructionist. I think there's a delicate dance between, an intricate dance between, you know, what I am because of what's inherent and what I am because of what's happening around me and my environment. And identities change as you move across boundaries.
Sure.
So it'll be very interesting to see where Peter lands up. I mean,
yeah.
I think he's already having his interviews for resettlement in the US. and he should probably be in the US by the end of the year. It'll be fascinating to see what happens when he gets there.
Because what your account, I mean, that's you've given a great sense of it, but a kind of abbreviated sense, because you follow the very, well, you follow him through the very different spaces that he has to negotiate, mm-hmm. navigate. Mm-hmm. And the house that you follow him to is this strange compound, kind of in a peri-urban area, as you describe it, where there's a community of 20 or 30 LGBTI refugees who form a kind of family structure that is also kind of a mini state. So you describe how when you walk into the house, there's a list of officials of the house on the door, and there's a president, and there's a deputy minister of education.
Peter's the deputy minister of education.
Yeah, so very interesting kind of conflation of you know, a mini state on the outskirts of the
Well,
city.
It's also about,
But it's also about, I mean, it's, you know, it made me think of the kind of voguing houses of Harlem.
Exactly.
You know, there's a kind of elective kinship structure that is all about patronage and protection, and but also real emotional bonds.
Well, I'm really interested in that. I mean, that's, I mean, the words you've chosen to describe it are very fine, elective kinship. Mm. I'm really interested in that, and it's particularly important when trying to understand this particular dynamic, because you know, the discourse in so many parts of sub-Saharan Africa, and particularly Uganda, is all around recruitment. Mm. If a kid like Peter has become gay, it's because someone's recruited him, an older person, not necessarily a white person, but a person with money. Mm. And in a way, I mean, I think that there's a kind of material foundation to that, which is that it's much easier to understand the stuff as a material thing, mm-hmm. as something that happens because you're needy or greedy, mm-hmm. rather than something that's like from the inside and sort of threatening of mm-hmm. a whole lot of ethical and religious precepts. Mm-hmm. So the recruitment narrative is really strong. Mm-hmm. And the recruitment narrative is often, again, what's sort of held against Western or global North human rights activists. Mm-hmm. You know, you're coming to recruit our people and you're paying money to them. But what I wanted to say is that the reason why, and I try and understand this and unpack this in my essay, try and unpack my own relationship with Peter, because it is a complicated relationship, because I'm seen as somebody who can help him, and you know, he calls me big bro, and it's a bit instrumentalist when he calls me big bro, but I have to remember that he actually has been chucked out of his family. He doesn't have brothers or mothers or fathers anymore, and there's something both affective, there might be something instrumentalist about him calling me big bro, but there's also, he's making his own family, and hoping, of course, that some benefit will come from those family relationships, the way benefit comes from family relationships in a kind of normative environment. And what I remark on in the piece, and I think is absolutely true, is that this dynamic, it's, you know, from the Nelly Queens of Victorian England to the voguing houses in Harlem to the Hijra communities I'm writing about in India. I mean, it's kind of universal, the way these elective kinship structures emerge the roles they play.
I mean, I guess what's interesting is that the elective kinship structure that emerges in this house where most of the people there are Ugandan refugees has affective and instrumental...
Of course. Of course.
But the instrumental side of those kind of elective affiliations become... are so much more obvious, perhaps, or one wonders about them when they are transnational. So when they are made with benefactors who are elsewhere. I mean, I'm not.
What's a leading question? Because
it's something that you give an account of.
So Peter has.
Because of that curious man in Arizona,
this interesting very weird guy in Arizona called Shane Phillips, who's like a reborn Christian, gay reborn Christian, who like wants to save the gays and undo all the harm that, you know, homophobic reborn Christians have done. And really, when he heard about what was happening in Uganda, he went online looking for, you know, gay Ugandans he could help. And he found Peter, and Peter found him. And in fact, Peter's headed to Shane in Arizona, which is scary a little bit. I mean, Shane's a good guy. He's just a little bit unbalanced. But Shane gave... So Peter... Shane gave Peter the money to leave Kampala. Honestly, I don't think Peter should have left Kampala. I mean, I don't give any advice one way or the other. I'm trying to learn from anthropologists about how to be a, you know, the limits of participant observation. But, you know, Peter obviously, you know, Shane was saying if you come to America, blah, 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 blah. So who knows whether, I mean, the terrible things did happen to Peter, no question about it, I've verified. He was thrown out of home. He was subject to the most really shocking entrapment and torture scene that I describe in detail in the book, in the essay. But then, did other stuff happening, or was this happen, or was he settling down? I don't know. But one way or the other, he went crying to Shane, and Shane told him, "Go to Nairobi." Shane gave him the money to go to Nairobi, and without that money, Peter would never have got to Nairobi. And so now, there's Peter in Nairobi. You know, and Shane is a kind of unemployed itinerant construction worker. But it's weird because, I mean, they speak to each other every week. Shane went to Kenya to meet him, saved up and went to Kenya to meet him. And as I understand, it's not a sexual relationship at all. And Shane is like, "This is my son. This is my gay African son." And Peter's like, "This is my white American dad." And we'll have to see how it plays out. I mean, this is the kind of transnational dynamic that's happening.
But I think what's so great about you giving us a sense of that in that account is it's the flip side, or it's the human face of the narrative about the discourse that is exported from the West.
Exactly. And that's why I'm interested in the story.
It's complicated, but these are real people who actually seem to have real connections.
Yeah, and you know, this whole question of agency. This notion that, you know, so much of the debate, the debate about this global culture wars around LGBT, sort of, the one side says, oh, it's the evangelical Christians that are making Africans homophobic. And pre-Christianity, African society wasn't homophobic. And it's only Christianity that introduced the notion of sort of sodomy as sin. And then it's the human rights activists in the other corner saying, you know, then it's the evangelical Christians saying to the human rights activists, "You're making these people gay by giving them ideas." Mm-hmm. You know, African people have their own agency, and like all of us, they're syncretic and hybrid, and they take ideas that come from other parts of the world and they put them together in their own way, and they invent themselves. And I think that's often forgotten in this global debate about, you know, what the West is doing to the rest. Mm-hmm.
Shall we? There's a lot more we could discuss, but I think maybe we should let people ask questions.
Yeah, let's extend the conversation. And anybody want to ask anything? Ed,
I should probably say, as organizer of this event, it was interesting. I wanted to think about pairing Johannesburg with Nairobi spaces, think about queerness. I think what comes, having read both pieces, what's struck me most actually about reading your memoir was the sense in which you were not so much queer in the city as thinking about the city as already queer and just opening out and making visible that already kind of queer space. Mm. And Johannesburg was always queer even before it had great gay pride marches as the former party, etc. But what seemed to come across in the extract in Safe House for me was the sense that you talk about the tension between visibility and invisibility, but actually there is still a sense of the kind of urgency of queering that space, and the city is a very different place to Johannesburg in the sense of its kind of relationship with its own queerness. And actually, what, as Andrew said, you have to kind of extract yourself from the city almost entirely into this peri-urban space to find a community in which kind of queerness could be kind of explored and thought about and even written about. And I wondered, as a writer traveling from Johannesburg to Nairobi, your relationship and how you understood Nairobi as a potentially queer city.
Look,
how these two spaces kind of rubbed up against
me. I mean, Johannesburg is my city. And it's also a city, I mean, the reason, Johannesburg is a, because, I mean, when I was growing up, there was this kind of Castro, Old Compton Street part of Johannesburg called Hillbrow, which was like a real sort of, you know, old-fashioned, we can say old-fashioned now, sort of gay ghetto. Because there's always been a kind of, there's always been a white community, European origin community in South Africa that's connected to what happens in the global north. So Johannesburg has its own particular history that I slot into in a particular way. And if one wants to understand Johannesburg's queer history, that's part of it. Nairobi is a much more foreign place to me, and doesn't have exactly the same history, even though, of course, there's also a settler community in Kenya, there is that history too. So the queer in Nairobi, which is a city I know less well, is much less visible to me. But it's there, and it comes. And I suppose one of the things that interests me, because I'm really interested in the kind of clash is too strong a word, the play between the global and the local. And you know how there's a global gay culture, and then there's kind of local expressions or regional expressions, and how they kind of work together. Now, in this era of globalization, particularly with the information revolution, I mean, that's the big thing. The global gay or the global queer or the global LGBT is huge. That's how Peter found himself in, that's how he found other queer people in Kampala, as he went onto Facebook. And that community is like, in a way, that's outside of the spatial bounds of a city, right? It sort of happens up here. And as a result of which, and then people will pull down those identities offline and then try and inhabit them, you know, on the streets. And so in a city like Kampala or Nairobi or Johannesburg, there's a growing community of particularly young people who understand themselves as gay or trans as well, or lesbian or LGBTI, and who find now in these globalized cities, find space for themselves. And I know where to find them. And in Nairobi, there's three or four gay bars, for example. And I know where to find, I can go there, and if I'm going to meet a friend for a drink in Nairobi, I know where to go, etc. But then there's all these other spaces that are hidden. And that kind of draw on references that I wouldn't even know about if no one told me about them. So, you know, for example, in Kenya, there are some ethnic groups where women are allowed to marry women solely for inheritance reasons, similar to the Igbo in Nigeria, right? So, to keep it in your bloodline, don't ask me to explain. You could probably explain a little bit about how it works, but there's a group called the Kimba where this happens. So there are sort of modern professional Kimba women who go to Nairobi, discover that they're lesbians, meet other women, take on the lesbian identity, and then retrofit their lesbian identity into these traditions, and find some space within the Kimba tradition for them to be together. And those are spaces that, I mean, I guess all cities have these kind of deeply subcultural spaces that are not visible to an outsider. But I think particularly in African cities where there's currently this thing happening at the moment about the global and the cosmopolitan on the one hand, I'm not going to say the modern, but the global and the cosmopolitan on the one hand and the sort of the traditional and the local on the other hand, there are these complex kind of networks of spaces in the city.
Can I ask a question? Something struck me when I was listening to you talk. I have read the book early on about the particular character of repression and how this might generate these sort of inner spaces like Peter's room, but on the other hand also sort of cross-border spaces, because you talk about the fact that, you know, the map just comes to an end and there's nothing at the end of your suburb. But I was thinking about what happened in the case of South Africa, you know, these kind of very verkrampt or very sort of hardline Afrikaners. They'd go across the border, and that would be for, like, not for gay sex, that would be, well, I don't know if they did, but just for sex.
And for sex with black people.
With black people, with prostitutes and so on. So in a strange way, there's a whole story about repression and sort of like finding a way out of it or something. And that was a South African story. But now we seem to be talking about a very different type of repression going on in some of these African cities with this whole rise of sort of homophobia, etc. So it just sort of struck me as an interesting point. You know, what's the sort of relationship of this repression and these inner spaces where you can somehow get away from the repression or having to go across borders? There's just an interesting kind of story there.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm not quite sure how to answer that spatially.
Yeah.
That would be interesting to sort of think about how to answer that spatially. But what is absolutely clear that there is a particular mode of repression now that is a backlash.
Right.
Right? And that's got to be understood. So there's homophobia now because there is a particular kind of expression that wasn't there a generation ago. And so when Yoweri Museveni, the Ugandan president, signed the anti-gay bill into law, it's since been struck down by the Constitutional Court on purely procedural grounds, he said, the difference between you and us, he was talking to Western journalists, is that we keep quiet about it. Which is quite sophisticated. It's much more sophisticated than Robert Mugabe.
Yeah.
Or then people who say your homosexuality doesn't exist in African culture. He's like, yeah, it exists, but we just don't talk about it.
Yeah.
So it's subterranean.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happening is that young urban people are claiming space. Well, they're claiming the urban space as their space.
Yeah.
And that's very threatening.
Mm.
I'm sorry, I'm answering at a tangent, David.
Sure, no.
But it's threatening. I think that it's threatening. Like, I think the patriarchs and the chiefs are terrified. And they're terrified precisely of boundlessness. Because we live in an increasingly borderless world, even though you guys might be about to be putting some borders up in a couple of weeks. But we do live in an increasingly borderless world because of globalization and because of digitization. And you kind of don't have control over your subject anymore.
Mm.
You know, yeah. So
especially through marriage, which is one of the
marriage is the way you control your subjects more than anything.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
So this has almost become a kind of marker of we're going to exert control. We can't exert control, but we're gonna draw this line in the sand and say, here is where we're exerting control.
Mm.
You can't marry who you like, you can't talk publicly about this. Almost as a way of holding on to some kind of shred of territorial control that no longer, that's just kind of not there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Matt?
Thanks. I wanted to go back to this point about fantasy that Andrew raised, some official fantasies.
Mm.
So one moment I really enjoyed in your memoir was these maps of these early maps of Joburg with tiny locations, imagining that you wouldn't need many non-white people to contribute the labour that the city would require, and the obvious ridiculousness of that. But I more broadly with fantasy, I was thinking, what happens if you tip some of the earlier discussion on its head? So we've been talking about how people are able to inhabit spaces with limits, or systems with all sorts of parameters. But to what degree does all of that sustain the plausibility of a load of official fantasies? And I'm wondering how that plays out in Nairobi. So what happens when, you know, Peter has to pretend a whole load of things about himself? Not only what does that enable him to do, but how does it sustain the apparent plausibility of an official story?
I'm not sure if I understand fully.
You mean like that there's actually no gays and
Peter
isn't gay?
So
that's a fantasy, official fantasy.
So, I mean, the way that Joburg was administered, clearly never really worked.
Yeah.
I mean, the parameters were always played with. Policing was always extremely limited. There was always fairly thin control. And yet there were all these things, there were all these signals that made it all look very real. Obviously there were real consequences. You could end up at the fort and so on. But it all looked very rigid because people had to perform that. In other words, the flip side to people having to inhabit these spaces is that they made the parameters a reality. And I'm then wondering how that plays out in Nairobi.
Yeah. I'm not sure if I have an answer for it. I mean, it's a very interesting observation. I mean, I'm thinking it through. I'm thinking about the braids in the beanie and the braids out of the beanie, and how you submit to a fantasy of who you are, but then try and challenge it, and what the nature of that challenge is, and sometimes you. I mean, the nature of desire and self-expression is that you don't necessarily intend to challenge it. You just can't keep the braids in the beanie, and so you make a lie of this fantasy in which you're participating. And that's kind of, I mean, it's such an interesting moment for sort of liberal African countries like Kenya, because, you know, I don't know if you saw what Uhuru Kenyatta said when he was asked the gay question with, any time Obama goes anywhere, has gone anywhere in Africa, like the gay thing has come up. Because Obama makes a point of it, but also because the journalists following him make a point of it. And it was all very, there was a dance, when Obama went to Nairobi last year, there was a dance around this issue. It was clearly scripted. They both knew they had to talk about it. And Uhuru Kenyatta said, it's just not an issue in our society. We have more important things to worry about. Because he wants to represent his society as kind of modern and global. And yet he has a constituency, and there's the churches, and it's this really weird moment for the African city, for the sort of modern African state, the rights-based, multi-party, democratic African state of like acknowledging like what fantasy are they going to play? Are they going to play the fantasy of being you know, this globalized world, sophisticated, bring your investment here story, or are they going to play the fantasy of the patriarchal, the tribal, the culturally sovereign? And they're kind of in conflict with each other.
But that self-presentation that you described for Kenyatta, I mean, Peter's playing right into it.
Absolutely.
By
no, that's why I was thinking.
By enabling a kind of a public story that he doesn't exist.
But I mean, that's for his survival, right?
Sure.
We get that.
To pick up on that question, I suppose it sounds like there's something kind of insufficient about the freedoms of the city that might exist in Nairobi that's kind of driving Peter to a life in America. And can you talk about what those emotional freedoms might be? I suppose they have changed in the sense that being kind of allocated space or able to pursue freedoms within parameters in the city that Nairobi might allow is insufficient for them.
Well, the one thing, I mean, just to follow on, it's Max, right? To follow on what Max said, it's about fantasy, and it's a fantasy of liberation in the United States, and it's what Shane's telling him about the United States, and it's what he's seeing online about the United States, you know.
Does he know he's going to
a exactly. I was going to say, it'd be a terrible sort of joke if he arrived there and Mr. Trump had
Arizona.
Sure. So a lot of that is fantasy, but a lot of it is also, I mean, Nairobi is a really interesting place, and it's one of the freer African cities for many reasons. But it still is a very socially conservative place, and there's not room to. So it's what I was saying about him believing he's on a voyage towards full sort of self-actualization and self-expression in a Western liberal mode, because he's sort of bought into that mode, right? And that's not possible in Nairobi. He has to keep the braids and the beanie in Nairobi. And he has this fantasy that when he gets to the United States, he can just shake his hair off. I mean, I think it's that simple. And there is this weirdness. I mean, he's only in Nairobi because that's a way station. Like, there's this weirdness about Kenya as a way station for LGBTI refugees, because sodomy is illegal in Kenya, right? In terms of, if you look at the you know, there's this global attitudes poll done by the Pew Center, which is an American kind of polling organization. The methodology is very dodgy, but it's all we have, actually. And if you look at the percentage of people in Uganda and the percentage of people in Kenya who think that homosexuality is a perversion or a crime or evil, it's the same. And in fact, I mean, it's one of the things that, so the these LGBTI refugees from Uganda are very unpopular in the gay community in Nairobi. They're seen as troublemakers. And they're seen as one of my friends put it, and I write it in my piece, professional gay fugees. Like, they're looking, you know, they're hustlers. That's how they're seen. And what my Kenyan friends say to me about them is, it's so much better in Uganda than it is here. You know, Uganda has gay pride. Uganda actually has an LGBT pride. And there's a really lively queer scene in Kampala, much livelier in Kampala than in Nairobi, which is one of the reasons why there's been a homophobic backlash in Uganda. Mm-hmm. Is because there was a very vibrant, outspoken movement. Ugandans are loud, Kenyans are quieter. You know, I mean, sorry to trade in horrible, you know, national stereotypes, but there's a kind of politesse to Kenyan society. You don't talk about things in the same way, whereas Ugandans can be pretty bolshy in some respects. And it's a kind of political culture of the two places. And so actually, in some respects, it's easier in Uganda than in Kenya. But for some individuals who've caught the rough edge of the official homophobia, such as Peter, mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't easier for them. Mm-hmm. But they have to come to get processed by the UNHCR. They have to come through Kenya. So they don't want to be there, mm-hmm. which makes them a difficult population as well. They really don't want to be there. They're not interested. And they're terrified that if they integrate, this came up a lot. If they integrate, they're going to lose their ability to resettle. Because one of the ways you get resettlement rights is you show the UNHCR that you are vulnerable and at risk at the place where you're in. So Peter has an agenda to show that he's vulnerable and at risk. Like, getting slapped for walking girly is in his favor when it comes to his moving to the United States. Because he can prove that he's at risk in Kenya, and therefore he needs to be moved to a third country. It's very complicated. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so I will just take one more question before we finish off.
First of all, thank you very much for your beautiful reading. I had a related question. You said something earlier that really struck me when you were talking about global queer politics, and you said you kind of marked the contemporary shift from behaviour to identity. Mm. And as the way you said it, it seemed like it was kind of an ambivalent thing, right? It brings great possibilities, but as we've been discussing, great threats too. And I'm thinking in terms of this backlash or this kind of reactionary responses to the greater visibility of LGBT people. How does that look like? What does that look like in somewhere like Joburg and Harlem, New York? So, like, what are the challenges? Are you seeing a kind of transnational, like uniform transnational challenges or kind of obstacles that queer people might have to deal with kind of moving continents? a special kind of link between Johannesburg and North America in terms of the awareness, either online or kind of what kind of the state of play is for kind of LGBT politics, right? Sort of the pitfalls, if that makes sense. So just what the backlash and kind of what obstacles are faced by African youths, I think, and kind of looking towards America, right? And if you see any kind of awareness or engagement with it, or the differences that that would entail.
Look, I don't know how to answer that directly, but just here's a few. I mean, clearly, we because of being able to go online, there are these global conversations, and there's global awareness, and if you're in one place, you have a sense of what's happening in the other place. And there's also these mechanisms for moving now, which is, it's in my piece, but I can't remember exactly when, but there was a moment, like 4 or 5 years ago, when the UNHCR accepted sexual orientation or gender identity, risk of persecution for sexual orientation or gender identity as a valid reason for claiming asylum. So apart from all the other ways that people move from one place to another physically, there's now this mechanism that's available that wasn't available before. And in fact, it began with Iranians in Turkey. That's where it started. It began with Iranians fleeing to Turkey. So there's a lot of consciousness and there's shared language. And the shared language is people kind of form online communities or look at what's happening elsewhere. How this translates into kind of offline subcultural expression is more complex. Because, you know, Harlem isn't Soweto, isn't Kibera in Nairobi. What I find really interesting and what I'm sort of tracking in my work is the way people reconcile a kind of online communal, almost universal identity with offline realities. And the particular dissonance that brings, and the way that dissonance kind of is a product of this moment, in a way that it wasn't for my generation, you know, because I just didn't have these I didn't have that global online community. So where it's really interesting, and is in the way in trans-asterisk communities, particularly in parts of the world where there are traditions such as Southeast Asia or South Asia, where there are these communities that are deeply, deeply, deeply entrenched, like in the social fabric, but often in ways that, in spaces that are very circumscribed. So there have always been hijras in Indian society, but if you're a hijra, you leave mainstream society, you go to an alternative society, and you really are only, you get castrated, and you're good for two things, begging and sex work. That's it. But you're there, and you've always been there. No one denies your existence. Notions of transgender that are rights-based and biomedical have entered Indian society in really interesting ways. Through the information revolution. And also through a kind of the growth of a middle class in India. So you've got a younger generation of Indian trans people who no longer call themselves hijras, but would now call themselves TG, and who have a very strong sense of their rights, and who are very interested in kind of the biomedical solutions which weren't available to previous generations or poorer people. These are educated people, and you know, one of the people I'm writing about actually just got poached from Google to Infosys, and the way she got poached is she was offered all the gender reaffirming surgery she wanted, because she's a really highly regarded software engineer. You know, so it's like an Indian company poached her from an American company. You know, offering her gender reaffirming surgery. So that's happening, but at the same time, there's still this terrible violence against hijras, kind of at the other end of the social scale. And there's also situations, like this has been documented in Bangalore, which is, you know, one of these high-tech cities, of, because of this new discourse, a whole lot of young women leaving the traditional feudal societies, these elective kinship societies, which in these instances are quite coercive and not so elective, because they don't want to be, you know, feudally controlled by their gurus or their mothers within the hijra system anymore. So they're like, I'm free, I'm an individual, I'm part of, you know, Western liberal urban society, I'm no longer part of this, this group that controls me. And the suicide rates among these young women is really high. So these are the complexities that happen.
Great. Anyway, thank you very much indeed to both of you, and that was really fantastic.
Buy Mark's books, and I'm sure he'll sign them for you.
Indeed, they are there.
Thank you very much. That's great.